The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Yes, it is Thursday. Yes, it is the Two Shot Podcast. You are here. I am here. We are all together. It's good, right? Lovely. How was your week? Yeah? Now, this week's episode, I'll be honest, it was rather more exciting for me to record than anybody else, and I'll tell you for why. As you know, for the past year or so, it's all been over the internet, remote, Zoom, Skype, you name it, I've been doing it. But this Saturday, I got up, I was making him breakfast, and I said, look, I've got somebody coming around to the house about tennis, so are you all right just to play upstairs for an hour, or you can, you know, watch the start of a film for an hour while I just record downstairs? Because that's right, I was having an actual living, breathing human being around the dining room table. I could make tea. I went and bought some pastries. It was so exciting to look into the whites of somebody's eyes and listen to them and not worry about internet dropouts or glitches or you're frozen or let's refresh. None of that. They were there in front of me, and it's Paul Popplewell. And he drove over from Yorkshire to my house, and we sat around the dining room table and made him some coffee. And we got down to it, and it was so fantastic. I don't want to go back to remote calls. I'd forgotten, actually, what it is to have somebody right in front of me and talk to them. It was an absolute joy, and he's fantastic. Look, you'll know Paul. We talk about his collaborations with Michael Winterbottom and Paddy Considine. You know, he's been in Tyrannosaurus and Journeyman alongside Tony Pitts and Jodie Whittaker. He played Paul Ryder in 24 Hour Party People, which we touch on. Most recently, he popped up in the second series of Save Me with Lenny and the Salisbury Poisonings, BBC One. He's great. He's great company, and it's a great chat. So let's get down to the very first, in such a long time, actual human-to-human two-shot podcast. Enjoy, and I'll see you at the end.
You must know about Proust's questionnaire.
No.
So, I might be wrong. He was about 14 when he wrote all these questions, which are supposed to be the greatest questions. And it's always in, they always give it to guests and celebrities in the back of Vanity Fair magazine. They've been doing it for years. So
we're going to do that.
We'll just do a little bit.
I'm eating a pastry.
Eat a pastry.
Nice thing of his pastry.
I'm going to have a pastry. Well, the thing is, hello everybody listening, by the way. I'm with Paul Popplewell, who is the first in-person guest that isn't remote and who's kindly come round to my house and was sat having coffee and pastries on a Saturday morning. It's nice to see the whites of somebody's eyes instead of a fucking computer screen.
Can you see the whites of my eyes? And my glasses gone clear again and not dark because it's sunny outside.
No, it is a lovely sunny day. So, Paul, give me a number Between 1 and 30. Sorry, I'm munching pedro. No, 1 and 30.
We'll do a few of these.
11.
There we go. Which living person do you most despise? I mean, it's not the most positive of questions to kick off, is it?
I don't think I despise anybody.
No, and it's a really
genuinely. I don't. There are people that I don't feel kind of good about, but I don't think I despise anybody. It's probably currently one of the politicians.
Yeah, but
I don't despise. That's proper strong, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I feel certainly you have to have in-depth knowledge of that person and that person's character to despise them.
It's like some of the politicians, they might be good people, you know what I mean? But they're making some terrible choices that make me a little angry sometimes. So despise would be a really strong word. I don't think I despise anyone. That's not the answer that you want, but
no.
It's probably the right answer.
No, I think it is the right answer I didn't know what the question was going to be until you said the number. Yeah. But sometimes, and you'll know this as well, I'm sure, as a dad, I say sometimes to my son, if he's describing a certain incident or somebody or something or an incident that's happened at school, and he'll use the word hate.
Yeah, and I go, knew you were going to say that. We don't hate anybody.
But just back down a bit. Just think about what you're saying there.
It's a strong word.
And he went, well, no, I don't mean hate, but you know what I mean. I went, I know what you mean, but you're an eloquent 10-year-old, so choose your words a little bit better and just... Mm-hmm. Back down.
That's why I picked 11, actually, because my son's 11.
Well, should we go and pick another number and see what other questions we can...
19.
19? Let's have a look. Oh, this is interesting. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
Gosh, I don't know.
Isn't it funny being asked these questions because we never get asked...
My stomach just dropped there. I don't know why. I don't know. I think it's probably being a good dad. I think I'm a good dad. I hope I'm a good dad. Somebody told me recently that they think I'm an ace dad, and that was like, that meant the world. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And I know that's probably a cheesy answer.
I don't think it is a cheesy answer because
I think it's like, you know, a lot of my career has gone on hold since I've had kids. I've turned a lot down, or I've kind of.
But your priorities
done
change.
A lot of self-sabotage in terms of my career in order to just be around my kids. Mm. Maybe that. Maybe being constant. I mean, I'm not saying I'm amazing. Some days they'd probably say I was crap. But trying to be constant and...
Present.
Yeah. And be a good dad and do stuff with them and engage with them and teach them decent morals. I think that might be it.
Do you question yourself as a dad sometimes? You know, sometimes when, say, you've got them to bed and you've had a particularly tricky day.
Yeah, sometimes I feel bad.
Sit down and...
If I've yelled. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No. We're having a natter. It's fine. But I question myself sometimes. But I do think we give ourselves a hard time as parents.
Yeah, I think, like, my mum and dad were ace, right? Don't get me wrong. But I think most people feel like this. I know that, like, there are certain things that they might have done or not done that you want to do differently. But in trying to, I don't want to use the word correct, but in trying to do that, sometimes you miss other areas. You take your eye off the ball in other areas. And, you know, I know we're all just ultimately doing our best. But, sometimes if I've yelled or if I've been, like, not very present and a bit trapped in my head and a bit snappy with them or a bit like, in a minute, darling, I sometimes kind of beat myself up when I put them to bed.
Well, it's interesting.
Think, God, I was a bit shit.
Yeah, because we got back last night after a big drive and my son just plonked himself right there on the settee and popped the telly on, and I knew I had two loads of washing to do. I had bags to unpack. I had food to put in the fridge. I've got, you know, little domestic jobs that you come home. And he said, Dad, can you just chill out and just come and sit? I said, I'd love to just sit down on the settee and plonk the telly on, but I need to get all these jobs. I've got limited time to do these things. And then later on, I thought, maybe I should have just stopped and just sat on the settee. But, you know, we're all just...
I get what you mean.
You know what I mean?
Like, that stuff is just stuff, isn't it? As long as there's the frozen food or the fridge food goes in the fridge, the rest of it, the washing, in theory, can can just wait.
But I knew that in like about 40 minutes, I'd have done all those little jobs. And it was Friday night, we were ordering a takeaway. I knew I had that in the post that was coming out. And we could sit down. And in the end, we did. And we sat down, we had pizza, and we watched a new film. And
brilliant.
And it was lovely. And we both had a little cry at this film. It was amazing.
Lovely.
It was
what
great.
Was
so
that?
This new film, I think from the Pixar bods, called Luca.
Oh, I saw the trailers for that. I'm going to watch
really,
that.
It's really
yeah,
good.
Yeah, we did Soul. We'll look forward to that one.
Yeah, yeah, I think yeah, I hard recommend with that. It's lovely.
Sea animals that come to Earth or something
yeah,
like that.
Sea monsters in Italy. But it's about so much more.
Yeah, there are always, there always there? Yeah. messages and depth.
And it's, we both had a little internal cry. We were just on the cusp. And even my son went, yeah, I was really near to going there.
That's nice.
Paul, tell me about growing up. Where were we growing up?
I grew up in the suburbs of Hull in East Yorkshire. And, in a not an artistic family at all. I know that's not what you're asking, but you didn't want a one-word answer, I don't think,
no,
did you?
Never.
Yeah, when I was growing up, what did my mum and dad do? My mum was a lab technician at a private school and then became delivered parcels for a catalogue and then became a mental health nurse. My dad was at sea.
What was he doing?
He was in the Merchant Navy, so he was away a lot.
When you say a lot, was he away for like large chunks of time and then back?
No, he stopped that. I've got an older brother who's like 18 months older thereabouts, and when we were babies, might have even been when Lee was a baby, but when we were babies, my dad stopped the deep sea when he was away for months and months on end and then would come back for a few weeks. He was on taking jet fuel and oil around the world on the big super tankers.
Right.
And he came back to more localised stuff, doing 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off, and doing that, delivering new cars around Europe and Africa and stuff. And then he had a heart attack, actually, one time. I did his last ever trip. Back then, you wouldn't get away with it now. I was talking about this last night when I was out running with someone. Me and my brother used to go away with him, like in the summer holidays or the two-week holidays. We'd do a trip and, like, work with the crew and just for fun, just to go away with Dad on the ship. And sometimes we'd have family holidays on the ship. You know, if he was going to San Sebastian or something, we'd just all, Mum would be sunbathing on the decks and we'd be just running around the decks playing football or painting with the crew or quite big ships.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea now, I'd be
health
horrified.
Health and safety wouldn't have it, would they?
No, I mean, we'd go down in the engine room on our own. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd be, where are my kids? Do you know what I mean? Have they fallen over? Because it was just little rails. Do you know what I mean? There weren't big barriers like you get on a ferry. There were just little rails, and it was fucking great. I loved it. But
geez, I have heart palpitations if he runs onto the next aisle for in Sainsbury's.
Same,
and I'm shouting around
same,
like
man.
A madman.
Same, totally. But I did my dad's last ever trip with him, actually, when I was about 13. It was the summer holidays, and we were one day late coming back for school. That's when he sort of, his term finished, and he was like, it don't matter if you start back one day late. But on that trip home, he had a heart attack when he was like 39, 40 or something.
God.
I was about 13. So he was pensioned off. I think things were tricky for a time financially, but then he got a job working for a direct sales and publishing company, and like our life changed in many respects. It suddenly became like working class to middle class, I think. Not that we're into class, but like suddenly the holidays that me and my brother had as kids changed, you know, like, and my younger sister started going off like on safaris with my mum and dad and shit like that. And why can't we go?
Yeah.
You're too old now. You know what I mean? You're staying at home. So their lives changed. So I've seen them do different things.
Did it change? Did it
change? Now they're both retired.
Did it change for you having your dad around more after that?
Yeah, I think it was a bit. It was an adjustment for everybody, actually. I think maybe you didn't really notice so much at 13. I was like, I'm not sure I was an easy kid.
In what respects do you say that?
I think I was the difficult one. Do you know what I mean? The
when you say you think, you know, don't you? You've done work on this and you know.
Yeah, I was the difficult one. I was the one that probably kept him up more at night, do you know what I mean? Even as a kid and certainly into my teens. But I was difficult. I was like,
Were you getting into trouble?
I was getting into trouble, yeah, but I wasn't a bad lad, do you know what I mean? I felt lost.
More of a rascal.
Yeah, but I was an annoying rascal, do you know what I mean? And I moved schools and things like that, and I spent a lot of time on report.
Did you move schools because of trouble?
Kind of. In my first term first year of high school, I was like, I need to get out of here. I'm going to go to that other high school that my friend goes to. And then that never happened. I had a lovely, lovely English teacher who was an ex-nun who actually became good friends with my grandma because they went to the same Catholic church.
Right.
Like, this was later in life, after I'd left that school. But she was lovely, Mrs. Priest, I think. Strangely apt.
Yeah.
I hope I've got a name right.
I hope you've got a name right. Yeah, it'd be terrible if it was.
Yeah, it would be. Or was it Priestley? Or is that my friend Emma I'm going to go see this afternoon? Anyway, she was lovely. And she was like, got me talking with one of the sixth formers who'd felt the same. I think I was quite creative. Like, at that time, I was just doing Bugsy Malone at the whole new theatre and play. And I don't know. But I remember getting this older sixth former who'd done drama to talk to me and stuff, and I don't know, I just felt, I always felt lost. This, I don't want this to sound like indulgent or anything, but no. I think I was just difficult. I was like, and it was always everybody else's fault, do you know what I mean? Nobody understood me.
Yeah.
So that's why if I move schools, I'll be all right. I can get a fresh start.
Exactly, but you can keep on leapfrogging and moving.
Tell me about that. I found that in later life that it wasn't them, it was me, and I had to take me with me wherever I went. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I found that out in my 20s, and you know, we're all right now. Me and me.
Yeah. it takes a bit of time.
But I did end up moving schools when I was about 13 because my brother wanted to go to sea, so he went off to a naval college, which started in the third year of
senior. Your brother wanted to go to sea?
Yeah, he did, right. Yeah. He ended up couldn't go because he was colourblind, but he went off to this naval college. And he was a bit, you know, he was a bit of a rascal as well. And when he went to this naval college, suddenly things turn around and he becomes a school officer, which is like, I suppose, like a prefect.
Yeah.
You know, you have buttons and stripes on your full Navy suit, you know what I mean? The 8 gold buttons, we wore all that and the hats and had to parade in the morning. And so by the time I was in my third year, which is what, 7, 8, 9, year 9?
Yeah.
As it is now, they were like, why don't you go? Fresh start and all that, you know what I mean? And it's done your brother the world of good. And I went and it was just, went from bad to worse.
Did it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I got in with the other rascals who'd gone for the wrong reasons, right. Who'd gone for a fresh start and not because they wanted to go to that school necessarily. And not that they were any bad lads necessarily, but like, and also because it was like, it was proper science. The one saviour was the English teacher, actually. He was amazing. And I'm on Facebook with him now still. Do you know what I mean? He's still in my life in some capacity. And he used to come and see me in plays at youth theatre. And I remember we were going on the ship on the Thames for a week and sailing from Kent and like this training ship that you could go on a proper ship. And we went up to Ipswich on it. And like, I knew I wasn't going to go on this school trip because he was getting to choose. And like, I knew I was... Nobody would want me there.
You're way down the list.
Yeah, I'm not even on the list. The headmaster said, don't fucking take him. Do you know what I mean? He's trouble. But he took me.
Right.
And he made a joke of it, you know, saying in every barrel you need a bad apple or something like that. But he was like...
Nothing like words of encouragement.
No, but it was a big wink.
Yeah, of course.
Because I knew he thought I was special and I thought he was amazing.
Yeah.
It was like, he was ace. And,
it's interesting, those teachers.
Yeah.
Because they do pop up.
Oh, man, I've talked to Paddy about this, actually. You know, and other people, but I remember a conversation because, like, you know, when everybody else, you feel, and I'm not saying it was like this, but I felt like everybody else is like, you're worthless, you're a pain in the arse, I was always getting told off, and probably rightly so.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, I remember getting dragged into the headmaster's office because someone had the motorbike damaged. Weirdly, a motorbike I ended up buying. But that's totally coincidental. But it was like, it was you, wasn't it? Like, it wasn't me. Like, it actually wasn't me. And I don't even, you know. It was, so there was always that presumption. So you kind of, it's like chicken and the egg, isn't it?
That's a different list, you're on. Whenever something bad happens, there's a list of 3 or 4 people who it could be, so drag them in because he's bound to be one of them.
And it wasn't me. But I suppose... I'm rambling here, but he took me, and he was like, he was just like one of those guys who he'd lived as well. And maybe that was something to do with it. He'd not always been a teacher. He'd lived life. I'm not saying there aren't teachers who've kind of, you know, left school, college, university and become teachers that are not like that. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I wonder if he'd lived a bit. He'd been a landlord of the pub in the red light district, and like he knew life, and he had the life experience, just saw something that he's actually a really good kid and he's just a bit lost.
It can be a cliche.
He got me through school, really, in many respects, and encouraged me and empowered me. And I felt like I was always seeking approval as a kid, you know what I mean? And I felt like I got some from him, and it was like...
But also it sounds like he was listening.
Yeah, he was. He was mega. I took my kids to meet him, actually.
Yeah.
There was an open day at the school when it was closing. There's a real old boys fraternity, and they were doing a hog roast, and like you could go look round the school before they bulldozed it in Hull City Centre. It's now called Zebedee's Yard, and they have concerts there, like Flaming Lips and Happy Mondays and Primal Scream, all played on this bit of yard in the city centre of Hull now. But that was our old school, you know. And I was like, I want you to meet this guy, you know. He was my English teacher. Yeah, he was a good man.
It's interesting. I mean, I know Steve
McGuigan, if you listen to
Shout out
Steve
McGuigan. Yeah. I mean, it can be a cliche when people say, yeah, but it's just one teacher and they just change everything. But it's kind of true because it happened for me as well with my deputy headmaster of my secondary school. And I'm still in touch with him now.
Yeah, you know, he's
down the road in Preston. Shout out Richard Catmore while we're doing shout outs.
Yeah, big up, Richard.
Now, should we do... This is kind of an interesting way of getting into the conversation by asking these questions, and then we can...
Okay.
It's just a different format. It seems to be working.
Cool.
Give me another number, Paul.
Eight.
What do you consider the most overrated virtue?
Oh. I don't know.
I mean, feel free to pick another number if you don't like the question, but I'd kind of quite like to answer it.
I don't know, really. The most overrated one. I don't know, maybe we'll come back to that.
Yeah. So you mentioned before about that you were doing Bugsy Malone at the time. Was this sort of extracurricular drama?
No. Straight. It's how I got into acting, weirdly. Acting was not on the agenda. I was doing a lot of sport, you know what I mean? Like, extracurricular for me and my brother. My brother and I was predominantly sport. We played rugby league. We did, like, Sunday league school. My brother played for the city. I played for county level. Played football for school. We tried all sorts as kids. My mum and dad were great, and they'd always, like, let us try stuff and karate, but we both got disqualified from our first tournament because we didn't know what we were doing. We punched people and things like that. Not that we were thugs, but you know, when someone's trying to kick you and things like that,
if it's coming at you quick,
bam, it's like you can't hit someone in the face. So that didn't last very long. We tried all sorts, but I was a massive fan of the film Bugsy Malone, you know, the Alan Parker film. Paul Williams, the music.
I think so, yeah.
And it was just like, it captured my imagination as a kid, as it probably does many kids of many generations. We had it on an old VHS, and I used to watch it all the time. My memory, and I'm not sure, you know, kind of not sure the memory is always correct, but I used to, it seemed like I watched it every morning before school or some of it, and on a night. And then when I was in my final year of primary school, the old fourth year of juniors, which would now be year six, would it?
Yeah.
They were going to do it in the drama club. I didn't even know there was a drama club, do you know what I mean? But they were going to do it, and I got the part of Bugsy, and it was like, wow, this is great. And it was good fun. And then the following year in the newspaper, there was this article for open auditions to this theatre company in Hull, which is like, they had an adult company, but they also had youth theatre and all the classes, you know what I mean? A full timetable every night of the week and all days on weekends of all the different performing arts, music, dance, musical theatre, solo drama, acting, group acting classes, a bit of everything. They were going to put on this production at the big Proscenium Arch in Hull. the whole new theatre as it was, which is like 1,200 seats or something like that anyway. And people were like, you should go for that. And it was just like alien to me. Like, and fear has played a big part in my life as well. Like always did as a kid and always did into even into adulthood. Like, so the idea of pushing out my comfort zone was not easy because I'll fall flat on my face. You know what I mean? I didn't have the insight then. But,
well, you certainly think you'll fall flat on
your face. Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Which is the fear.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what will people think? And I didn't have the insight then. It was just like, just fear. I probably didn't even know it was fear, just this feeling of dread and no. But a lot of people encourage me, you know, school friends, parents, my parents, school teachers. So I went for it. And the music teacher at primary school helped me with a song, and I had to go do like a monologue or whatever and a song. And then I got a recall. And they offered me the part of Bugsy, me and another lad. We shared the role. And that was it, really. Was that the question? I got the part. I joined that youth theatre as well. And that was kind of opened doors to me, really. And then the sport started taking a back seat when I'm turning up for Smike rehearsals with stitches in my leg because I've been playing rugby that morning and I can't do any of the movement for the rehearsals because I've kind of got my leg straight with bandages on it because I've split my knee up and playing rugby. And before I knew it, like, the sport was less and less, mainly just at school, less Sunday league and weekends. And suddenly found myself at 16 making my choices. What was I going to do when I was left school? And desperately seeking my dad's approval, I was filling out forms to go to sea for an apprenticeship, going up to South Shields to the Naval Merchant Navy College to do my certificates to be a navigation officer.
God.
With P&O containers and things like that. And vague recollections of having emotional conversations with my mother in the kitchen where she's like, but what do you want to do? You know, not what your dad wants you to do. And I think she tells the story. I don't really remember it. And I was also took up being a lawyer as well. I would never have been a lawyer. I mean, like, I had no application at school. There was no way I'd have got through university and law school. But it was like, you know, my mum was encouraging me. So was my dad. But and I said I want to be an actor. I'll stop fucking about, I think my mum said, and do what you need to do. So I decided I would go to sixth form college.
In Hull?
In Hull.
Yeah.
Media studies, theatre studies and art.
What was that course like? Was it renowned? Did you have anybody that had been through it?
It was good, yeah. Loads of people, including your friend Julie Campbell.
Julie Campbell, past guest of this podcast. Yeah,
and loads of people who'd been through the same youth theatre and had gone on and were having successful careers in London as actors, do you know what I mean? And the guy who ran the youth theatre and the theatre company in Hull was also head of drama at the sixth form college. But again, I was interested in girls and partying, you know what I mean? I've just had no real application.
Well, what age were you at this point?
16.
Well, there you go.
You know, and I don't think I'd written an essay, and I was... I'm not proud of this at all, but, you know, I do love this podcast because people open up and are honest, and... But I kind of ended up seeing the school counsellor, do you know what I mean? Because I was getting pressure to hand in assignments of which I had no intention of really, the idea of sitting down to write an assignment. I was like, oh, I've got loads of problems. And then, do you need to see the counsellor? Yeah, okay. I'm thinking, well, if it's going to buy me a bit more time, yeah, let's do it. And then around November, December, I'd only started in September.
Right.
I'd already dropped art. Because I thought, oh, it's in for me. They want me to, like, really care about it. And I was good at drawing and painting and things like that. And I enjoyed art at high school. I got a decent mark in my GCSE. But I could see these people were, like, proper into it. Do you know what I mean? I was like, nah, it's in for me. Also, again, you had to hand pieces of work in. You know.
Well, so it kind of comes with the territory, Paul.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, all right, I'll just do the theatre studies and media studies. You know what I mean? And then the head of drama put it to us that there was someone from the BBC wanted to audition some kids for a film. So he got loads of us together. There was a mixture between people who went to the youth theatre, people who were on the sixth form college course, many of which did both, but there were some who didn't go to the college, and there was some who went to the college but not the youth theatre. And he got us all in this huge room in the Ballet Studio at the youth theatre place.
Yeah.
In Hull, one night or day, I can't remember, probably a Saturday. And this director who was going to direct this film for the BBC came up, and she'd done like the agencies in London looking for kids. Weirdly, I know a lot of people who went up for it, peers who were a little bit older than me, who had agents. And then she'd done the drama schools in London looking for a boy and some girls from the north, and hadn't found anyone. So she thought she'd better head up the motorway, and she started doing youth groups. I'm sure she probably did the Nottingham and Oldham and along the M62, and she found this one, and she came, and this poor woman sat through God knows how many monologues.
Oh, you had to prepare a monologue?
I think I'm pretty sure we did.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure. Could be wrong. And then she just workshopped us. And then a few of us started getting recalls to Bradford, to this hotel in Bradford city centre. I want to say the Palace, but that's Manchester, where I've stayed many times. But I think it was the Queen's, maybe.
Right.
I don't know. It's like near the interchange, Bradford Interchange. Anyway, that's by the by. I do ramble a lot. So
this is good.
Feel free to edit or put it out in two parts.
This is what the podcast is all about, Pop. Don't worry.
Anyway, so we went a couple of times, and there was a few of us, and I ended up landing the lead in this film about this boy. It was based on a true story about a boy who was probably autistic, though not diagnosed in any way, shape or form. And he took his own life in prison when he was, I think he was 17, or he was maybe 3 weeks past 18. I can't remember whether it was 3 weeks before his 18th birthday or several weeks after, but he was a young boy who was on remand who should never have been in prison. He wasn't a criminal. His home life was tricky. He left home at 16, totally inadequate. His neighbour helped him get like a bed sit.
Right.
Bullies got involved in his life. There's some bullies in the film, and they sort of represent many groups of kids and bullies. His flat got burnt down. People used him as parties, and he got into petty crime with the bullies, like maybe odd burglary or nicking lead off a roof. Certainly that's in the film. And nick a kettle. He nicked a kettle from a builder's porter cabin, do you know what I mean? Because he wanted a hot drink, and I'm welling up.
I can feel it
like now, because Simon Willerton, I still think of him a lot. And he took his life. He went to prison for crimes that netted him no more than a tenner on remand in Armley, and killed himself. The letters in the film that he writes to his family are the letters.
Oh.
Strangely, they gave the letters. They were suing the Home Office at the time, again, which was strange, because I'm not sure how involved they were in his life, and I'm sure they're still alive, some of his family and brothers and sisters and maybe his parents, so I don't want to be disrespectful at all. It must have been awful. But anyway, yeah, I got that role, and that got me an agent. Did you ask this question?
Yeah.
There was a wonderful lady, Corinne Campbell-Hull directed it, and she'd found the story on the radio, I think. And Vincent O'Connell, who I'm still in touch with, who I did one of his films a few years ago called ID 2. He'd written ID 1, the first football Hooligan film.
God, what a terrifying film.
Well, he made and wrote the second, and I did that with him. So I've worked with him 2 years, like almost 20 years apart. But he wrote it. And Vincent and Hilary Salmon produced it, who's now a big exec at the Beeb, who I've worked for since, like, you know, on dramas such as Inside Men and things like that. I know we're not here to talk about work, but like people who you still see around, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's strange. And even when I worked with Hilary all those years later, on Inside Men, she was on set. And I don't know, execs, you don't often always see them. I know you do, but like, and maybe because we'd known each other since I was 16, I was a boy.
Yeah.
And she'd been breastfeeding, like, and her boy is now like 20 odd. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
And weirdly, she lived on the same road as my friend Sam in Crouch End when you guys were all at Mountview.
God.
So I used to stay with Sam in Crouch End, yeah, just around the corner from Banners. You know what I mean? So, like, the world. So I knew her, do you know? And we would talk about Simon when we were filming this drama a few years ago, you know.
Interesting about the connections that you make, and then sometimes it takes that amount of time to come full circle and come back together.
Yeah,
but you're interesting. Yeah. I know we don't talk about work loads on this, certainly not when I'm talking to actors, because for all sorts of reasons, but you know the reasons, I don't have to reiterate it. But when I think about you and I look at your work all over the years, I always find myself, I feel very lucky when I work with a writer or a director who I respect and we just click and it just works and it becomes something else. Well, regardless of whoever sees it, it becomes something personal. And I think you have forged certainly two very close relationships with people that you've worked with time and time again, one being Michael Winterbottom, the other being Paddy.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you've just gone on and you seem to come back and collaborate a time and time again with you know, these fantastic creatives.
Yeah, it's strange, really. I mean, I don't know, something weird just happened to me then. I feel a bit lightheaded and out of body experience because I love those two men, like, deeply.
Yeah.
Michael and Andrew Eaton, Michael's long-time business partner. They're not business partners anymore, but they're still dear friends and weirdly, not weirdly at all, actually, because he's a good friend, but strangely, having not seen Andrew for a number of years, I had dinner with him in Cardiff a few weeks ago.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and I'm having dinner with him on Tuesday in Cardiff again, as I'm down there again next week. But for those listeners who don't know, Andrew is a film producer and produced Michael's work, and they were on a business film company together for years. I don't know. Do I need to explain that?
Yeah, I think they can always look it up. It kind of does matter. So his backstory is good. Andrew produced nearly all of Michael's films up to only a few years ago, I would imagine.
Yeah, a few years ago, And they, you know, they're great friends, but sort of Andrew's doing other stuff now. And Michael's still doing his own stuff. Anyway, but I don't know how it happened. I met Andrew and Michael in a room in London in 1996-97 for a film that never got made.
So you'd have been about 20?
17, maybe?
No.
18, I'm 44, so...
Yeah, I'm 45.
I did Criminal in, like, 94.
Right.
When I was 16. I was 17 just after it finished, probably 17 when it went on telly. Got my agent when I was 17 through Elaine Donnelly. I was going to, just to take a back segue a second, I was going to say earlier, and I think I started saying there was a lovely lady, as well as the director and the writer of the film, and Hilary Salmon, the producer, there was a lovely lady, an actress called Elaine Donnelly, who was the younger kid's chaperone on Criminal, and like an acting coach. She helped us. She worked with us. And she helped me get an agent. She was and she took me under her wing when the film finished. She took me to her house in Nottingham, which is weird because I've just been listening to you and Sam Morton talking about Nottingham on your podcast. And she was married to Elaine Dosser, Alan Dosser, the TV director, and they were making Between the Lines back then. And she took me on set. Because, like, I didn't know anybody from the acting world at all. And suddenly I'd been the centre of this film, and it had been my life.
Yeah.
I'd been 16 living in a hotel and long days on set every day. And then everybody just goes, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
They, like, literally, that's a wrap and they're gone.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting you say that because I was about to say, you never have that aftercare.
No.
It's like that you saying that and they're gone just reminds me of when I sat down with Tony Pitts.
Yeah.
And I think he says something like, and the circus left the town.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go with them, but they were going.
They're gone. So, but Elaine was lovely and she helped me with Spotlight Contacts.
That's very rare that happens to younger actors at that point when they don't know anything.
No, she got me in a scene on Between the Lines. There's an
Did
extra.
She? Oh, but just brilliant.
Like, there was a fight, you know what I mean? And I think Neil, is it Neil Pearson?
Yes.
Yeah, he was in this scene, and who I later worked with on ID2, strangely. Oh, like, you know, we were just talking about, you know, maybe 20 odd years later. And I told him about this. He would never remember, but like, I had met him when I was about 17. And there was this fight in this scene, and they were like, do you want to get in it? You know, like, and it was just like, it was not to give me an acting job, it was just to have a nice day and be a part of. And then I had dinner with all these cinematographers at their house and totally fell out of my depth because I was an inadequate 17-year-old with no conversation skills particularly.
But also, you didn't have any knowledge. What could you add to the conversation?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So I was, you know, she helped me get an agent. So anyway, but that's what I was going to say earlier. And got me, you know, into the industry, if you like, because without that agent, I'd have just gone back to college, I suppose. Or, don't know, ended up working something else. But
it's like what you said about a teacher that listens.
Yeah.
You just need one person to go, actually, I'll just come here, give me a hand, and let's go through this door and have a look at this and see if this is for you. And it turns out it was.
Yeah. Yeah, she was great. I've never really seen her since. We just very quickly drifted, but she was lovely. Another person, a bit like Steve, the teacher, who, you know, will forever remain a very fond and place in my heart.
But that's kind of what I was saying before about you come back and your collaborations with Mike and your collaborations with Paddy. Come back and we don't have that. These brilliant people come into our lives and we have a very sort of close, intimate relationship, hopefully sometimes, you know, an inspiring relationship, and it changes, and then they've gone.
Yeah.
But they were only in your life for that amount of time. And they might not come back, which is why what I was saying before about when I think about you and your career, I think you're so lucky that you come back and you collaborate and carry on building these relationships.
I never really talked about that because I wanted to just mention Elaine. But I met Michael and Andrew in a room in London somewhere when I was about 17, 18, 19. I don't know, it's still young. Very early into having an agent, I think they'd seen Criminal. You know, it was in the days of Screen 2, so it was like they were big popular dramas. You know, they were the single dramas.
Just for people who are slightly younger and they won't know what sort of a Screen 2 was, should we just sort of explain what they were?
For sure. The BBC used to regularly, and less so now, I guess.
Yeah,
make one-off single dramas for BBC One and BBC Two, and they were either a Screen One or a Screen Two, and like, you know, you look back at the back catalogue and there were some phenomenal dramas with some phenomenal writers, directors and actors and crew and everything, obviously, but many went on to like do, you know, be our great kind of the older generation of like, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
I suppose they were
the your Julie Walters and your kind of Pete Postlethwaite and all these kind of, you know, phenomenal.
They were almost like a modern version, an updated version of Play for Today, which happened. But they were almost like a training ground. They were like what the old version of like rep theatre would be, but on television. They gave people
they were on all the time,
smaller budgets, and I feel that they gave them freedom.
I mean, our budget, I think, was about £1 million. I shot a feature film a few years ago literally a few years ago, when obviously things are a lot more expensive now. For like 330 and I features, which I think three films share £1 million.
Yeah.
You know, so £1 million, wasn't that shabby back in 1994.
No, that is good.
But I remember George Faber coming down, who was the exec, who went on to own Company Pictures, didn't he? And did many amazing things.
Yeah, of course.
And they were talking about needing more money, I think, and like, you know, you were sort of in the bar, you were hearing conversations and the politics and stuff. It was quite interesting.
But I feel then they would have given them a bit more. I would have hoped they'd give them more sort of creative freedom.
Probably.
To roll the dice and cast somebody who doesn't have the experience that, you know, someone in the BBC might want over there, and give them a bit of a platform give them a bit of a training ground. That's what I would. Maybe that's my sort of romantic notion of what sort of that
know.
Screen one, screen I, two, I, play I, for today I, vibe. I was saying know. The other day that wouldn't it be great to bring those types of things
It
back.
Was amazing, but I mean, like, you know, they were on a lot.
Yeah.
And we get less of that now, don't we, single dramas? We get 3-4-parters, 6-parters, series. See, yeah. Things that run and run.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they were great. Anyway, so Michael and Andrew, I think, had seen that. Got me in for one of the leads in this feature film that never got made, actually. I don't know why, whether it was a funding thing or... I think it was about Joyriders and things like that. And I think... was there a cinema or a TV film called Shopping and something? I can't...
No, it was just called Shopping.
Just Shopping.
That's and right. It was Jude Law, Sadie Frost.
That's
and it was the Natural Nylon bunch. And yeah, for people who don't remember...
Absolutely correct.
Natural Nylon was, I think I'm right in saying, a production company founded by...
Reefis and Ewan McGregor, Jude,
Sadie Frost, Ewan McGregor, Sean Pertwee, I think. That was maybe they sort of got that idea first about the Joyride.
I don't know. I'm not saying that that's why Andrew and Michael didn't make theirs, but I remember that coming out not long after and thinking, gosh, that's very similar to that script that I read. I'm sure there are probably reasons.
But it's usually the way, isn't it? Do you remember when Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves came out and then Patrick Bergen's Robin Hood came out kind of at the same time?
Don't
you don't remember that?
No, but I mean, that happened recently, didn't it, with the two Capote films, Truman Capote films.
Yeah, well, it always keeps
good,
happening.
Actually.
But, you know, around... sort of Gladiator time, there was a whole host of sort of those types of films that were coming out, and Troy and things like that. It always crops up, doesn't it, in the film industry.
Yeah. But anyway, I met them and it didn't come to anything. And then years later, maybe not years later, I can't remember the timelines, but about 96, 97, I got an offer to be in, it was a straight offer, I think. And it was only a tiny part. It was one scene to be in Michael Winterbottom's I Want You with Alexandra Nivola. And was it Rachel Weisz?
Yeah.
So I did a little bit in that. So they'd obviously remembered me and got me back in that. And then a few years later, again, 24 Hour Party People comes around. And I was about to fly to Egypt, actually.
To do what?
Just backpack.
Right.
2000, it was.
Just to take yourself off?
Yeah, yeah. Take myself off with a mate I'd met at the RSC who we kept in touch, and we were both living in London. I was just waiting to finish a film I was doing in London, and then it was like, let's go to Egypt, and we booked this trip through student travel, STA on Shaftesbury Ave. Do you remember?
There you go, I do.
And we went off, and I met Michael in like, I'd come up to Yorkshire to get my rucksack and some stuff, and I was going back to London, but came via Manchester to meet him in the production office, which ended up being the film's production office. So they must have been in pre-production, I guess.
Yeah.
Whole area of Manchester now no longer exists. You know what I mean? It's changed so much since then.
Whereabouts was it? Do you remember?
I can't remember really. No, it's like piecing it together. It might have been Ancoats. It was just on the outside. You wouldn't even recognise it. It was right on some water somewhere.
Right.
It's changed so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I was last year working, rehearsing at the Exchange, like 2017, and it's changed so much since then. I'm driving around going, man, this is all new again.
Well, I was messaging you the other week when you were talking, I think you were talking about, were you doing some sort of photo shoot like on the roof of...
That was 24 Hour Party People.
Yeah.
It'll have been on a roof of a building that no longer exists right round here.
Yeah.
But anyway, I met Michael for that, and then they offered me a part in it. And that's when our friendship began. Like, before that, they were just people who'd seen my work and who I'd met, you know, and who had me in on their film. Like, even when I did I Want You, I never...
No, because you just pop in.
You don't speak to anyone, do you, really? You check into your hotel, you turn up for set, you do your bit, and the director's polite. I'm not even sure whether I met Andrew on set then. But Andrew and Michael are brilliant people. And their third AD, Mike Elliott, I think he was the third on I Want You, became Michael's first on 24 Hour Party People. And then now Mike owns his own production company, you know, called Emu Films, which has a base in London and a base in Manchester. And I've done one of Mike's films as a producer called The Goob, which Andrew Eaton No, he wasn't involved in that, but Andrew ended up executing another of Mike Elliott's films called Jawbone, written by Johnny Harris. So, like, their relationships, it's not just me who's had long, long relationships. They've had long relationships with a lot of people.
Yeah.
I was talking about this with Andrew when we had dinner the other week, just saying how much I love him and how much he is loved. Like, everybody on that film loves him. You know, your Martin Moscrops, who was our music coordinator on that film, who from the band ACR, Factory Records Band. I'd put a picture on Facebook or something of me and Andrew or something, and everybody who knew him from 20 years ago was going, God, I love that man. God, you know.
Yeah.
They nurture people.
Yeah.
You know, they still work with people, you know. Anita Overland, who's a producer.
God, yeah.
Worked with Michael and Andrew a lot. I think now works with Mike Elliott producing stuff. I think I could be wrong there, but I think they produced some Steve McQueen drama over lockdown, did they, that was on? Forgive me if I'm getting all my facts wrong, but yeah. I guess all I'm trying to say is that they're just great people who are loyal and want to get people back in. And I'm not the only one who's like Michael worked with a lot. You know, you've got your Kieran O'Brien, your Shirley Henderson, your John Sim.
No, of course.
You know, a lot of people that they are part of his repertoire. And he's never offered me big stuff again, but it's always like, oh, I've got this, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? He did a film called On the Road, which was kind of following the band Wolf Alice around.
Yeah.
And it was just really, he was only having two actors in it, two young actors who meet, and he was going to immerse them in the crew. So the crew didn't know they were actors. They just kind of, you know, they were going to shoot this thing with no scripts and follow the band. And he asked me to come on board and... I don't really know why, actually. And I did wonder whether it's... I was only on it a few days because I only had, like, a four-day window because I was due to start Journeyman. And I went on it, and I think... I wonder. Maybe I should ask him. Because I didn't make much of the final cut because it wasn't really about me. It was literally about these two characters who meet and have a love story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I partly wonder if it was just because I'm so used to the way he works, if I could just help them just kind of doing some improv, and not that they're not capable of that, but
no,
they
but
were
still
well
it's...
capable. Just kind of somebody who gets it and
yeah.
just like naturally be around it. It was to sort of play the road manager, and partly because the guy who was going to come and help road manage it wasn't available for a while, but I think he was more practically road managing as opposed to acting. Anyway, I'm rambling, but yeah, I think that was the last time I worked with him, 2016. But I did text him the other week, actually, and Melissa, his partner. So, you know, they're still in touch with these people, and they're just good friends. You know?
But it's incredible that when friendships are founded like that at work and the loyalty that comes on, and you talk about, like, those are two people in a great position where they can nurture new talent, and they certainly did that. You know, I look back now at, you know, Ralph and like John, and everybody looks so young in 24 Hour Party People. But
what a cast!
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
It's just like phenomenal.
Can you imagine nowadays getting all those people together in one film? It wouldn't happen.
The cameos, you know, of like Simon Pegg and Rob Brydon and John Thompson and Chris Eccleston,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was just... And they're pulling in them favours from people like Chris, you know, because of the loyalty and the love for them. And,
do you think that's nice? Do you think that's where a lot of friendships were forged on that set?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm still in touch with loads of people on that to a greater or lesser degree. I spoke with Kieran O'Brien the other week. I haven't seen Kieran for 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know that I bumped into someone up a mountain the other week who I hadn't seen for 19 years on that film.
Yeah. I didn't. And the funny thing is, I was round that person's house 2 weeks prior to that for dinner, and I didn't even know he was in it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's so interesting because you look back, and I haven't seen that film for a long time. But,
I can't watch it, really.
But I remember being quite blown away. Because of the age that I was, it was just, I was just missing all that. But it was such chaos on screen, controlled chaos, obviously in the edit. Was it like that film? Did it feel like the train has left the station?
Yeah, I mean, it was wild. I don't know whether it was ever supposed to be wild. But it was wild. And the party went on for about 2 years. You know, I remember being out in London with Chris Coggle, who'd played Bez.
Yeah.
And Kieran O'Brien, who had played Nathan McGough, the Mondays, Happy Mondays manager. We all became friends and we'd been running around Soho and Kieran's flat up in Marylebone Way for days. And finally coming back to my flat in Camberwell to voice messages, you know, on your landline.
Yeah.
Mobile batteries well and truly been dead for days. But like, I had this big old fax machine with an answer phone, and it was like, I think it was Andrew Eaton and Gina Carter, who was the co-producer on it as well, going, where are you? We're trying to get hold of you. We're in Cannes. Do you all want to come? Can you get hold of everybody? Like, ring us. This was 2001, so it's only the month after we'd finished filming. We filmed, I think, February 2001 to April 2001, so maybe about 8 weeks thereabouts. I can't remember exactly. But Cannes in May, isn't it? Is Cannes Festival in May?
Yeah, it's early, yeah.
So 2001, they're like, come out. And they're like, you know, we'll be paying, so it won't be like, you know, no film company's paying for it. We'll be paying, so it won't be uber extravagant, but we'll, you know, we'll get you cars and hotels and sort you out and everything. And, you know, so I'm like, yeah, fucking hell, we'll come, jump in the shower, you know what I mean? And like, right, we're gonna bike you around a camera, a film camera. The Sony PD-1, whatever they were, 180s.
Oh,
I don't know. I might be making up the name, but it was what the film was shot on. We shot on quite a lot of these handheld cameras. I say we, yeah, not me.
Yeah.
Was it Robbie Muller was the operator, the DOP, and Marcel, who's gone on to be, I think Marcel, who's gone on to be a brilliant DOP in his own right. And they shot hundreds of hours. I mean, hundreds of hours. God knows how he ever edited that to like 90 minutes or 2 hours or whatever it is. And they banked me around this camera in a plastic carry case with a load of money. And it was like, we'll sort you some flights, come out. And I don't know if we came out that day or the next day, but it was like imminent. It was like,
yeah,
it might have even been that day. I can't remember. And the other lads who lived in Manchester came from Manchester. Actually, maybe Chris Coggle hadn't been running around town with us for a few days because I think he flew in from Manchester. It doesn't really matter. But the point is we went out there and then we went out the following year. And so it kind of went on for a while, do you know what I mean? And it was just chaos. We ended up pulling a publicity stunt that first year, throwing dead pigeons around.
Because of that scene?
Yes, yeah, so there's a scene in the film where Paul Ryder and Sean Ryder poisoned pigeons, which may or may not have happened, you know, the myth or the legend.
I mean,
you know, and that's the point of that film.
Yeah, it is.
What's better, the myth or the legend, the fun story or the truth? So we threw these pigeons around, and I think our publicists kind of got blacklisted for a few days because, like, blood was shed and pigeons landed in the Coen brothers' dinner, and they thought it was fucking amazing. You know, it was like, it was great fun. It was good times, and we were young, you know, and we were having it. I'd never been a can before, you know.
It was the first time I'd seen Coggle with his hair cut.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was good times.
And is that where you first met Paddy?
I met Paddy on that film.
Yeah.
And again, it was very hazy, you know what I mean? We were all staying in the Palace Hotel in Manchester and, you know, we'd film.
Did they put all of you in the Palace?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, just light the fuse, but that's
it, isn't
it? I
think Steve might have had an apartment around the corner. Maybe some of the others.
Yeah.
Ralph was in and out the Palace and in and out the Malmaison. But I think he was taking the money and putting himself in the Malmaison, I think. But really, we were all there.
Oh, exactly. Slightly dangerous, putting everybody there.
I mean, it was wild. It was every night of the week.
Yeah.
You know, and it was...
Well, I've worked with so many people over the years that have had a smaller or larger, you know, part in that film, and the stories that you get back.
Yeah. God, I remember Sam Riley. I don't want to tell other people's stories, but he had a little part in it
playing
Malky Smith, and obviously Sam's a big star now, and... You know, going back to all those people that were in it. But, I mean, I remember seeing Sam in there in, you know, early hours of one morning. And, I mean, it was crazy. I think that was the night I broke breakdance and forgot to put my hands out. And, you know, I did the swan dive and forgot to put my hands out, I think. And
Smashed.
I just put my teeth through my face.
During shooting?
I think so, yeah. I woke up the next morning, my pillow was covered in blood. Danny Cunningham, who played Sean, I think he woke up in my room or he knocked on the door. We'd often wake up in the same rooms, even though we all had nice rooms.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's just blood everywhere. And I'm like, what the fuck happened last night? Oh, we were breakdancing and you didn't use your hands. I don't mean to glorify it, but it was good fun and we were young and it was, yeah. But that's where I met Paddy. And Paddy and I liked each other. I liked him a lot. Although I don't remember having that many amazing conversations with him because it was always so messy.
Yeah.
But I liked him. I liked his energy. I liked him as a person. I remember we only had one scene together and I remember distinctly saying, God, I'm so glad we get to work together, like actually get to work together. The scene got cut actually because he was chasing us around Main Road, but we were all in like 70s, 80s clothing and everybody else was in like 2001 shirts, so it was just not usable.
Yeah, yeah.
The police nearly stopped us that day for inciting a riot actually.
Did you not get permission to film?
But like me and Danny were wearing Man United scarves and stuff. Me and the as characters, Paul and Sean Ryder, and Rob Gretton, who was Paddy's character, was a City fan. Was a Man City fan. So the scene was he was chasing us around Maid Road, and we were, you know, yelling and shouting and hurling abuse at Man City fans. Well, of course, the general public just didn't really know. That it was a film.
Yeah.
And, you know...
Of all the places to do it.
Yeah, on match day. It was on a match day.
Oh, really? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is insane.
I know, yeah, yeah. And I don't think we got shut down. I don't know. Maybe my memory's really hazy about it all. But anyway, the scene didn't make the final cut because of that. It just didn't match. We were in 70s flares and, you know, old scarves and everybody else is in, like, more modern clothing, I think, is probably why I didn't make it. But anyway, I sort of ramble on a bit. But we just became... I liked him. And then I used to see him around at, like, awards dues. And yeah. We were sat on the same table at the Empire Awards one year and me and Paddy were both getting autographs. I remember we were getting autographs, you know what I mean?
From other tables.
From other tables, yeah, yeah. And I was getting them, I don't know who he was getting them for, but I was getting them for me, like, I think family friends' kids, you know what I mean? Because I knew Dominic Monaghan and I'd come to get know Orlando Bloom through Dominic, so I knew some of the Lord of the Rings lads and we used to party with them and stuff. And so I'm kind of going around Gandalf, you know what I mean? And Ewan McGregor, obviously he was on in that film, but he was there. And, like, I lost those autographs. I remember leaving him at our publicist's house. We ended up back at her flat until early hours, and I left it all there and never got it back because I was going to give them to my cousin's kids. But anyway, that's by the by. But I used to see Paddy around a lot, and then again, like so many other people in life, let alone this industry, you sort of drift, don't you?
Yeah.
We lost contact, not through anything other than you just lives took a different tack. And then I saw him backstage at Leeds Festival in about 2016. No, sorry, about 2006 in sort of the guest area. And it was like, it was a bit like me and Dan on the mountain last week.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing where you lock eyes across a crowded field and it's like,
no,
Paddy, Paul, wow, big embrace. Like we'd only seen each other yesterday, nattering away, catching up. And he told me about the short film he'd written.
Which was Dog Altogether.
Which was Dog Altogether. And asked me if I wanted to be in it. And I was in it. And then kind of that just rekindled, you know, it kind of reconnected us. And yeah, that was like 2006. So what is that now? Do the maths.
Well, what, we're 2022, aren't we?
Yeah, so 17 years, so 15 years.
God. Now, I was talking about short films the other day and I gave Dog Altogether as an example of a fantastic short, but also, and I don't know if this was the case, but it always seemed to me that it was, here's the trailer, is the opening of what I want to do as a feature.
It's never like that.
Wasn't it?
The opposite. No,
wow.
No. Panny would probably be better served telling the story, actually. So if I get it wrong, sorry, Paddy. No, it was always a short. It was always meant to be a short. I know a lot of people think I've got an idea for a feature.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can make a short version. And
but it always seemed like it was the opening. It was the opening of introducing all these characters.
Well, it is. I mean, literally, and you probably know this, but it is literally the opening.
Yeah, it is.
So the first 15 minutes or 16, 17 minutes, however long Dog Altogether is as a short film, is literally the opening minutes of Tyrannosaur, the film. They reshot it. But it's the same.
It's pretty much, yeah, it is, yeah.
And the scenes are pretty much the same.
Yeah.
But what happened was he wrote the film. It did really well. It won the BAFTA, didn't it? And
yeah.
I think it won a lot of other stuff critically. And people would ask him. He got asked a lot, I think probably in interviews, but also just in general conversation, the sort of thing that you're asking now, is it meant to be a feature? Or what about the characters? What happens to the characters, and he always thought he was more interested in what happens to the female character. What's her story? What's her background? And what's her journey? Than Joseph, the male,
yeah.
Mullen's character, more Olivia Colman's character. And I think, and again, I say Paddy is probably better served. I'm just interpreting what he's told me and what I've heard him tell other people. He just sat down, he decided, I'm going to find out, and he sat down, and he wrote it in one sitting, pretty much. The film we shot is pretty much draft one. It just poured out. And he found out what happens to him when he wrote it. And as I say, he'd be better off telling that story, but that's the bones of it.
It's so interesting. It's a bit like Tony Pitts, when Tony Pitts... Yeah. Sits down to write, it's usually the first draft. You know, Tony.
Yeah, I do, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Paul,
so, yeah.
I'm going to end kind of where we started.
Already? I'm enjoying this. I'm
enjoying this.
Just warming up.
Oh,
I usually don't talk. I'm usually kind of...
Well, for someone who doesn't talk, we're doing very well.
I know, I'm usually like Mr. Private and don't ask me anything about me and super kind of...
I used to ask a question, and I very rarely ask questions because you know what this podcast is like. We just have a conversation and we see where we go. But I used to end with a question, and it was similar to what I'm going to ask you now, but I used to ask, are you happy?
Yeah.
I used to ask, are you happy to some people?
I don't like that word happy.
No, I know. But the thing is, well, it's funny you don't like it because it's going to
come up in
a minute.
Well, it's not that I don't like it, but I'm like more like content.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's very rare that we get asked this.
Yeah.
But I'll ask you this, and if you don't like it, then
well, it's not that I don't like it. It's like, I just think it's like, some people say, I want to be happy. Okay, but what does that, what's that
answer? Well, that's a completely different question,
well,
isn't
it? Is it?
Yeah.
You've not even asked your question yet, so I'm going to shut up.
But just going back to Prue's questionnaire, when and where were you happiest?
That's interesting. In life or in my career?
I think you can interpret the answer of that question any way you like.
That's a really, really deep question.
Yeah.
And no, I don't have a problem with answering a deep question, but I do want to kind of...
Think about it
and, like, get it right. But I think in terms of my career, and I know that's not really what you're asking, but I always said this to Paddy, like, I feel most alive creatively when I'm working with him and other people, you know, not just him, but, like, I probably feel my most valued on his set.
Because of how he makes you feel?
Yeah, yeah. You feel like you're... Maybe it's because he's an actor, maybe it's because he's a friend, or maybe it's just because he is who he is.
Well, yeah.
As a person. But I always feel...
He's got a very particular energy, hasn't he?
Yeah, and also I've never auditioned for him. Do you know what I mean? And, like, I'm not good at auditioning. I don't have huge confidence.
Even after all this time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. After all this time.
What is it about that, then?
I don't know. I just, like, I had this conversation with Andrew Eaton the other week when we had dinner. And I was like, he was saying about, like, you've got a great body of work and people love you. And, like, I was like, yeah, I don't see that, though. I just see, like, a dad trying to graft, and do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I sometimes have, you know, side hustle and day jobs and doing what I have to do to pay the mortgage and feed my kids. Not that, like, you know, we're hand to mouth or anything, but, like, it's just like I don't see that version of me. That's not who I am. I don't communicate with art people in the arts on a daily basis. Do you know what I mean? It's like, not because I don't want to, it's just that's not my day-to-day reality. It's
just about
dropping the kids up, picking them up, I mean, taking them to gymnastics or football or whatever. Like,
and the day's gone.
Yeah, the day's gone and, like, boom, I sit down and maybe watch some on telly or you know, I watched a lot of football during lockdown because there was loads of catching up. But anyway, what am I trying to say? I'm rambling like mad. Auditioning. I'm not good at auditioning. I always think, just give me the job, I'll fucking nail it for you. You know, I talk myself out of jobs because, like, I can't do it. Or
does it ever get to a point with you where, a bit like what Andrew was saying, you've got a good body of work and we're doing this for over 20 years, and it's like, well, you know I can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to jump through those hoops again?
Yeah, and I wrestle with it. Like, I wrestle with it because of, like, I've done a lot of work on myself, like, as a person over the years because I've had to. And so I've got a bit of insight, right, into human nature and my own human nature. And sometimes I have to question my motives about that and, like, make sure I'm not saying it out of ego because I'm not one of them. Do you know who I am?
I'm
just not that person.
We know that.
But, like, I'm like, I did get asked to audition for a short film recently, and I'm like, I'm not auditioning for that. Like, it's nice, it's a good film, but I'm like, 25 years of work, endless bits of, like, I was like, look, send them this link and send them that, and if they want to offer me, I'd love to do it. Do you know what I mean? But, like, it's a bit like that. That sounds quite grand, and I don't
I know you don't
mean
it
audition.
Like that.
I'll audition for, like, a couple of lines in summer, but I do feel like that sometimes after... what I'm trying to say is, like, Michael offers me stuff, Paddy offers me stuff. I haven't auditioned for Michael since 24 Apart People, which is 20 years ago, and I've never auditioned, met, casting, whatever we want to call it. You know, meeting, interview, whatever you want to call it, for Paddy. You know, for Journeyman, he sends me a text going, I'm sending you a script, mate. I want you to do it. You know. So you immediately feel valued.
But there's a trust there as well,
Paul. Yeah, there is. And
so, of course, you're saying when you're on the set with Paddy, of course it's the most alive you feel because there's a mutual respect and there's trust
there.
And
you're brought in, he leaves you voice notes. He's the first. It seems that everybody's doing voice notes now, but it's been a thing that... I only ever used to know from Paddy. He'd just leave voice notes all the time, and he would leave them in the morning. You know, going, I'm thinking about this for today. Let me know when you get there. And you just feel like it's a real collaborative piece. And I've done theatre work like that as well, you know, most recently on a Maxine Peake project. And you just feel a part of, like, this is collaborative and this is really interesting and we're all in this together.
But isn't that one of the reasons we got into it in the
first
place?
I don't always feel that.
But you don't always feel it.
Particularly when you're guesting or stuff like that.
You don't feel it all the time because it's not always there all the time. That's the point.
But that's why I feel alive. So it's nothing to do with being offered stuff or not offered stuff, but you feel more, like, valued and, like, creative and alive creatively, which makes me feel content, and which I'll probably choose to say instead of happy. But
also, surely in that moment, it's best for everybody because not just you, anybody in that situation is going to be producing the best work.
Yeah.
Because they're grounded.
So. Yeah. And you feel like you're safe to explore or give or not give. And yeah, I struggle with auditioning. Like, I do audition loads, you know, and self-tapes and stuff, but I question myself too much and double question. And I know you never asked this question, but it's like, I don't know what you're like, but, like, I remember when Tyrannosaur opened some really interesting doors and suddenly I was getting seen for stuff that I could only ever imagine getting seen for. And I used to nail the first audition. And then I'd be sat in the room with the recall and surrounded by people who I've admired their work for years, who I think, oh, they're not going to give me it. when they've got that as an option, are they? And then, like, before I go in for the second audition, I've already talked myself out of it, and I just have a fucking near-on panic attack in the room. Not literally, but, no. Like, you know, I'm going under. And I can barely speak, and I'm thinking, I fucked that up again. And I saw on Twitter a while ago about, there's a casting person talking about, like, you know, if you can't deliver in the audition process, you won't be able to deliver on set. And
I don't agree with that.
I totally disagree with
that. Yeah.
Because, you know, as I say, people have offered me work and I just smash it. And that's the, and sometimes people have offered me work and I maybe not smashed it.
as is the way with everybody, yeah.
But, like, yeah, I just think, just give me it and I'll be great for you.
Yeah, but she can't, whoever that was.
Well, it doesn't matter.
But it doesn't, like, matter.
It's,
no, it doesn't matter.
Not to discredit anybody, but I just
not
thought.
At all, but...
I don't agree with that. That's all I thought was. It's not about agreeing or disagreeing. It was just like, that's not my experience. My experience is, if you give me the job, I'll thrive. But if you put me in an audition room in that pressure and that situation, I kind of go under a bit.
But it's a completely unnatural scenario.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
That's not, you're not on set. You're not, the other people aren't there. No, I disagree. Yeah. I do disagree with that.
And maybe I'm taking them out of context, but that just reading that statement, I thought, that's not my experience. So happiest at work, yeah, in life, when I'm at my most happiest. When I'm in nature, probably.
Well, I was going to say, because...
When I'm in nature, I went camping on my own the other week. Like, obviously, when I'm with my kids, that's kind of a given. Do you know what I mean? I took my kids paddleboarding recently, and then a couple of times, and kayaking, and like, oh, do I have to get off the Xbox? And then when we get there, like, wow, this is amazing. Can we come next week?
Yeah.
You know.
Half the battle's getting them out there.
And we've been since, and they love it, and they want to go again, and stuff like that. But just nature. I've got into running the last few years, and I much prefer running in trails than I do the road. I went off to the lakes on my own the other week, took a one-man tent and kind of went wild swimming in a tarn up the mountain and wild swimming in Lake Coniston, which is still quite cold.
It looked beautiful, though.
Yeah, and just walked up the mountain and ran down it. I'm kind of quite technical running, so I really pelted it down the mountain, bouncing off rocks and stuff, and I feel alive. I just feel like... And you look down on nature... Oh, you kind of up at the old man of Coniston, you see Lake Coniston and other lakes, and you see the Irish Sea, and you just think, we are so small, you know what I mean? And, like, the world, God, whatever you believe in, like, nature, whatever, is just infinite, finite, you know? And I just, yeah, that's when I think I feel alive, when I'm kind of connecting with my own soul and nature, not to sound too kind of, but I'm just like, yeah, I think... Happy. I don't really go in for happy. Not. That's when I feel content and alive and at one and just like, yeah, I'm all right. And when I'm staying in good mental, emotional, spiritual well-being and I'm just okay in my own skin without the distraction of a phone or music or telly, I can just sit. When I can do that, then I know I'm in a good place. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's when I'm looking that I'm after fix, or I'm on Rightmove looking at houses I can't afford. Do you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, you know, maybe something's a bit out of tune here. But I don't know whether I'm answering your question. But yeah, when I'm looking after myself and I'm in a good space and I can sit with myself, I think, yeah, I'm all right here. I'm content. Or when I'm in nature, or when I'm running through woods or whatever, I just feel. I don't even have to be running. I could be walking or just like nature is. I found this out in later life. I mean, I always kind of knew it. My mum and dad used to take us, you know, in nature as kids. But like, I got distracted by partying and girls and, you know, life. And I'm reconnecting with kind of all that over the last few years. And I'm loving it.
It's important, but, you know, life does get in the way. Paul, this has been a joy. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And another episode. episode is done. What a delight Paul is. If you haven't seen any of the films that we very briefly touched on, then do go back, do take a look at Dog Altogether, which is Paddy's short film that, which I think we discussed, was pretty much shot for shot the first sort of, I don't know, 10 or 12 minutes of the feature film Tyrannosaur. Do go back and, yeah, gird your loins with that. It's strong stuff. Well, look, here's hoping that from now on it's going to be person-to-person podcast recordings. I mean, if there's one thing I could... Well, no, it's not the one that there's many things I should wish for. That would be way down the list of more important things. It's just a podcast. But, yeah, I really hope we get to do more of these. I have a sneaking suspicion that there will be some remotes coming up. But still, look, if we can carry on getting the episodes out, that's all that matters, really, isn't it? Yeah. Look, thank you so much for downloading. Please do me a little favour. If you can't support us on Patreon, I know sometimes it's difficult. Month to month, people drop off, people come in. If you can support us on Patreon, we are patreon.com/thetwoshotpodcast. If you like what we're doing, these free podcasts that we're giving week in, week out, and going through the back catalogue, I mean, just go and pick who you haven't listened to yet. You may be surprised. Yeah, if you can support us there, that'd be fantastic. If you can't, here's what I'd really like you to do. If this month you can't afford to throw us a few quid, that's okay. Don't worry, somebody else is going to do that for you this month. Could you go and tell a handful of friends or post about it on social media? That would be really good because, you know, spreading the word really, really helps us. So do that. You know where we are. We're on Twitter at Two Shot Pod, Instagram, Facebook. If you want to drop us an email, you can. It's always lovely to hear from you. We are twoshotpod@gmail.com. See, I know the email address now after 5 years. Well, look, I've got to go. I've got to pack some cases and get out of Dodge quick as possible. But I will see you all next week. So until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care of yourself, all right? The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.